Anne stopped abruptly. Sell? Where on earth did Ashley get the money? You know they never have a cent. Melody spends it as fast as he makes it. Rhett shrugged. I always thought her a frugal little person, but then I'm not so well informed about the intimate details of the Wilkes family as you seem to be. That jab seemed in something of Rhett's old style, and Scarlet grew annoyed. Run away, dear, she said to Bonnie. Mother wants to talk to Father. No, said Bonnie positively, and climbed upon Rhett's lap. Scarlet frowned at her child, and Bonnie scowled back in so complete a resemblance to Gerald O'Hara that Scarlet almost laughed. Let her stay, said Rhett comfortably. As to where he got the money, it seems it was sent him by someone he nursed through a case of smallpox at Rock Island. It renews my faith in human nature to know that gratitude still exists. Who was it? Anyone we know? The letter was unsigned and came from Washington. Ashley was at a loss to know who could have sent it. But then, one of Ashley's unselfish temperament goes about the world doing so many good deeds that you can't expect him to remember all of them. Had she not been so surprised at Ashley's windfall, Scarlet would have taken up this gauntlet. Although while a terror, she had decided that never again would she permit herself to be involved in any quarrel with Rhett about Ashley. The ground on which she stood in this matter was entirely too uncertain, and until she knew exactly where she stood with both men, she didn't care to be drawn out. He wants to buy me out? Yes, but of course, I told him you wouldn't sell. I wish you'd let me mind my own business. Well, you know you wouldn't part with the mills. I told him that he knew as well as I did that you couldn't bear not to have your finger in everybody's pie, and if you sold out to him, then you wouldn't be able to tell him how to mind his own business. You dared say that to him about me? Why not? It's true, isn't it? I believe he heartily agreed with me, but of course, he was too much of a gentleman to come right out and say so. It's a lie! I will sell them to him, cried Scarlet angrily. Until that moment, she had had no idea of parting with the mills. She had several reasons for wanting to keep them, and their monetary value was the least reason. She could have sold them for large sums any time in the last few years, but she had refused all offers. The mills were the tangible evidence of what she had done, unaided and against great odds. And she was proud of them and of herself. Most of all, she didn't want to sell them because they were the only path that lay open to Ashley. If the mills went from her control, it would mean that she would seldom see Ashley, and probably never see him alone. And she had to see him alone. She couldn't go on this way any longer, wondering what his feelings toward her were now. Wondering if all his love had died in shame since the dreadful night of Melanie's party. In the course of business, she could find many opportune times for conversations without it appearing to anyone that she was seeking him out. And given time, she knew she could gain back whatever ground she had lost in his heart. But if she sold the mills... No, she did not want to sell, but... Goaded by the thought that Rhett had exposed her to Ashley in so truthful and so unflattering a light, she had made up her mind instantly. Ashley should have the mills, and at a price so low, he couldn't help realizing how generous she was. "I will sell," she cried furiously. "Now, what do you think of that?" There was the faintest gleam of triumph in Rhett's eyes as he bent to tie Bonnie's shoestring. "I think you'll regret it," he said. Already she was regretting the hasty words. Had they been spoken to anyone save Rhett, she would have shamelessly retracted them. Why had she burst out like that? She looked at Rhett with an angry frown and saw that he was watching her with his old, keen, cat-at-a-mouse-hole look. When he saw her frown, he laughed suddenly, his white teeth flashing. Scarlett had an uncertain feeling that he had jockeyed her into this position. "Did you have anything to do with this?" she snapped. "I?" His brows went up in mock surprise. "You should know me better. I never go about the world doing good deeds, if I can avoid it." That night she sold the mills and all her interest in them to Ashley. She didn't lose thereby, for Ashley refused to take advantage of her first low offer, and met the highest bid that she had ever had for them. When she had signed the papers and the mills were irrevocably gone, and Melanie was passing small glasses of wine to Ashley and Rhett to celebrate the transaction, Scarlett felt bereft, as though she had sold one of her children. The mills had been her darlings, her pride, the fruit of her small grasping hands. She had started with one little mill in those black days when Atlanta was barely struggling up from ruin and ashes, and want was staring her in the face. She had fought and schemed and nursed them through the dark times when Yankee confiscation loomed, when money was tight and smart men going to the wall. And now when Atlanta was covering its scars and buildings were going up everywhere, and newcomers flocking to the town every day, she had two fine mills, two lumber yards, a dozen mule teams, and convict labor to operate the business at low cost. Bidding farewell to them was like closing a door forever on a part of her life, a bitter, harsh part, but one which she recalled with a nostalgic satisfaction. She had built up this business, and now she had sold it. And she was oppressed with the certainty that, without her at the helm, Ashley would lose it all. Everything that she had worked to build. Ashley trusted everyone, and still hardly knew a 2x4 from a 6x8. And now she would never be able to give him the benefit of her advice. All because Rhett had told him that she liked to boss everything. "Damn Rhett," she thought, and as she watched him, the conviction grew that he was at the bottom of all this. Just how and why, she didn't know. He was talking to Ashley, and his words brought her up sharply. "I suppose you'll turn the convicts back right away," he said. "Turn the convicts back? Why should there be any idea of turning them back?" Rhett knew perfectly well that the large profits from the mills grew out of the cheap convict labor. And why did Rhett speak with such certainty about what Ashley's future actions would be? What did he know of him? "Yes, they'll go back immediately," replied Ashley, and he avoided Scarlett's dumbfounded gaze. "Have you lost your mind?" she cried. "You lose all the money on the lease, and what kind of labor can you get anyway?"
"I'll use free darkies," said Ashley.
"Free darkies? Fiddledy-dee. You know what their wages will cost, and besides, you'll have the Yankees on your neck every minute to see if you're giving them chicken 3 times a day and tucking them to sleep under eiderdown quilts. And if you give a lazy darkie a couple of licks to speed him up, you'll hear the Yankees scream from here to Dalton, and you'll end up in jail. Why, convicts are the only—" Melanie looked down into her lap at her twisted hands. Ashley looked unhappy but obdurate. For a moment he was silent. Then his gaze crossed Rhett's, and it was as if he found understanding and encouragement in Rhett's eyes, a glance that was not lost on Scarlett. "I won't work convicts, Scarlett," he said quietly. "Well, sir," her breath was taken away. "And why not? Are you afraid people will talk about you like they do about me?" Ashley raised his head.
"I'm not afraid of what people say as long as I'm right. And I have never felt that convict labor was right.
But why—"
"I can't make money from the enforced labor and misery of others."
"But you owned slaves."
"They weren't miserable." And besides, I'd have freed them all when Father died if the war hadn't already freed them. But this is different, Scarlet. The system is open to too many abuses. Perhaps you don't know it, but I do. I know very well that Johnny Gallagher has killed at least one man at his camp, maybe more. Who cares about one convict, more or less? He said the man was killed trying to escape, but that's not what I've heard elsewhere. And I know he works men who are too sick to work. Call it superstition, but I do not believe that happiness can come from money made from the sufferings of others.
God's nightgown! You mean... Goodness, Ashley, you didn't swallow all the Reverend Wallace's bellowings about tainted money.
I didn't have to swallow it. I believed it long before he preached on it.
Then you must think all my money is tainted, cried Scarlet, beginning to be angry, because I work convicts and own saloon property and... She stopped short. Both the Wilkes looked embarrassed, and Rhett was grinning broadly. Damn him, thought Scarlet vehemently. He's thinking that I'm sticking my finger in other people's pies again, and so is Ashley. I'd like to crack their heads together. She swallowed her wrath and tried to assume an aloof air of dignity, but with little success. Of course, it's immaterial to me, she said.
Scarlet, don't think I'm criticizing you. I'm not. It's just that we look at things in different ways, and what is good for you might not be good for me.
She suddenly wished that they were alone, wished ardently that Rhett and Melanie were at the end of the earth so she could cry out, "But I want to look at things the way you look at them. Tell me just what you mean so I can understand and be like you." But with Melanie present, trembling with the distress of the scene, and Rhett lounging, grinning at her, she could only say with as much coolness and offended virtue as she could muster, "I'm sure it's your own business, Ashley, and far be it from me to tell you how to run it. But I must say, I do not understand your attitude or your remarks." Oh, if they were only alone. So she wouldn't be forced to say these cruel things to him, these words that were making him unhappy.
"I've offended you, Scarlet, and I did not mean to. You must believe me and forgive me. There's nothing enigmatic in what I said. It's only that I believe that money which comes in certain ways seldom brings happiness."
"But you're wrong," she cried, unable to restrain herself any longer. "Look at me. You know how my money came. You know how things were before I made my money. You remember that winter at Terra when it was so cold and we were cutting up the carpets for shoes and there wasn't enough to eat and we used to wonder how we were going to give Beau and Wade an education. You remember..."
"I remember," said Ashley tiredly. "But I'd rather forget."
"Well, you can't say any of us were happy then, can you? And look at us now. You've a nice home and a good future. And has anyone a prettier house than mine, or nicer clothes, or finer horses? Nobody sets as fine a table as me, or gives nicer receptions, and my children have everything they want. Well, how did I get the money to make it possible? Off trees? No, sir. Convicts and saloon rentals and..."
"And don't forget murdering that Yankee," said Rhett softly. "He really gave you your start."
Scarlet swung on him, furious words on her lips.
"And the money has made you very, very happy, hasn't it, darling?" he asked, poisonously sweet.
Scarlet stopped short, her mouth open, and her eyes went swiftly to the eyes of the other three. Melanie was almost crying with embarrassment. Ashley was suddenly bleak and withdrawn, and Rhett was watching her over his cigar with impersonal amusement. She started to cry out. "But of course it's made me happy. But somehow..." She couldn't speak. Chapter 58. In the time that followed her illness, Scarlet noticed a change in Rhett, and she was not altogether certain that she liked it.
He was sober and quiet and preoccupied. He was at home more often for supper now, and he was kinder to the servants and more affectionate to Wade and Ella. He never referred to anything in their past, pleasant or otherwise, and silently seemed to dare her to bring up such subjects. Scarlet held her peace, for it was easier to let well enough alone. And life went on smoothly enough on the surface. His impersonal courtesy toward her that had begun during her convalescence continued, and he didn't fling softly drawled barbs at her or sting her with sarcasm. She realized now that though he had infuriated her with his malicious comments and roused her to heated rejoinders, he had done it because he cared what she did and said. Now she wondered if he cared about anything she did. He was polite and disinterested, and she missed his interest, perverse though it had been, missed the old days of bickering and retort. He was pleasant to her now, almost as though she were a stranger. But as his eyes had once followed her, they now followed Bonnie. It was as though the swift flood of his life had been diverted into one narrow channel. Sometimes, Scarlet thought that if Rhett had given her one half the attention and tenderness he lavished on Bonnie, life would have been different. Sometimes it was hard to smile when people said, "How Captain Butler idolizes that child!" But if she didn't smile, people would think it strange. And Scarlet hated to acknowledge, even to herself, that she was jealous of a little girl, especially when that little girl was her favorite child. Scarlet always wanted to be first in the hearts of those around her, and it was obvious now that Rhett and Bonnie would always be first with each other. Rhett was out late many nights, but he came home sober on these nights. Often she heard him whistling softly to himself as he went down the hall past her closed door. Sometimes men came home with him in the late hours and sat talking in the dining room around the brandy decanter. They were not the same men with whom he had drunk the first years they were married. No rich carpetbaggers, no scalawags, no Republicans came to the house now at his invitation. Scarlet, creeping on tiptoe to the banister of the upstairs hall, listened, and to her amazement, frequently heard the voices of René Picard, Hugh Elsing, the Simmons boys, and Andy Bunnell. And always Grandpa Merriweather and Uncle Henry were there. Once, to her astonishment, she heard the tones of Dr. Meade. And these men had once thought hanging too good for Rhett. This group was always linked in her mind with Frank's death. And the late hours Rhett kept these days reminded her still more of the times preceding the clan foray, when Frank lost his life. She remembered with dread Rhett's remark that he would even join their damned clan to be respectable, though he hoped God would not lay so heavy a penance on his shoulders. Suppose Rhett, like Frank. One night, when he was out later than usual, she could stand the strain no longer. When she heard the rasp of his key in the lock, she threw on a wrapper and, going into the gaslit upper hall, met him at the top of the stairs. His expression, absent, thoughtful, changed to surprise when he saw her standing there. "Rhett, I've got to know. I've got to know if it's the clan. Is that why you stay out so late? Do you belong..." In the flaring gaslight, he looked at her incuriously and then smiled. "You're way behind the times," he said. "There is no clan in Atlanta now. Probably not in Georgia. You've been listening to the clan outrage stories of your scalawag and carpetbag of friends." "No clan? Are you lying, trying to soothe me?" "My dear, when did I ever try to soothe you? No, there is no clan now. We decided that it did more harm than good because it just kept the Yankee stirred up and furnished more grist for the slander mill of His Excellency, Governor Bullock.
He knows he can stay in power just so long as he can convince the federal government and the Yankee newspapers that Georgia is seething with rebellion, and there's a Klansman hiding behind every bush. To keep in power, he's been desperately manufacturing Klan outrage stories where none exist, telling of loyal Republicans being hung by the thumbs and honest darkies lynched for rape. But he's shooting at a non-existent target, and he knows it. Thank you for your apprehensions. But there hasn't been an active Klan since shortly after I stopped being a scalawag and became a humble Democrat. Most of what he said about Governor Bullock went in one ear and out the other, for her mind was mainly occupied with relief that there was no Klan any longer. Rhett would not be killed as Frank was killed. She wouldn't lose her store or his money. But one word of his conversation swam to the top of her mind. He had said, "we," linking himself naturally with those he had once called the old guard. "Rhett," she asked suddenly, "did you have anything to do with the breaking up of the Klan?" He gave her a long look, and his eyes began to dance. "My love, I did. Ashley Wilkes and I are mainly responsible." "Ashley? And you?" "Yes. Platitudinously, but truly. Politics makes strange bedfellows. Neither Ashley nor I care much for each other's bedfellows, but Ashley never believed in the Klan because he's against violence of any sort. And I never believed in it because it's damned foolishness and not the way to get what we want. It's the one way to keep the Yankees on our necks till kingdom come. And between Ashley and me, we convinced the hotheads that watching, waiting, and working would get us further than nightshirts and fiery crosses."
"You don't mean the boys actually took your advice when you..."
"When I was a speculator? A scalawag? A consorter with Yankees? You forget, Mrs. Butler, that I am now a Democrat in good standing, devoted to my last drop of blood to recovering our beloved state from the hands of her ravishers. My advice was good advice, and they took it. My advice in other political matters is equally good. We have a Democratic majority in the legislature now, haven't we? And soon, my love, we will have some of our good Republican friends behind the bars. They are a bit too rapacious these days, a bit too open.
You'd help put them in jail? Why, they were your friends. They let you in on that railroad bond business that you made thousands out of."
Rhett grinned suddenly, his old mocking grin. "Oh, I bear them no ill will. But I'm on the other side now, and if I can assist in any way in putting them where they belong, I'll do it. And how that will redound to my credit. I know just enough about the inside of some of these deals to be very valuable when the legislature starts digging into them, and that won't be far off from the way things look now. They're going to investigate the governor, too, and they'll put him in jail if they can. Better tell your good friends, the Gellerts and the Hundens, to be ready to leave town on a minute's notice, because if they can nab the governor, they'll nab them, too."
For too many years, Scarlet had seen the Republicans, backed up by the force of the Yankee army, in power in Georgia, to believe Rhett's light words. The governor was too strongly entrenched for any legislature to do anything to him, much less put him in jail.
"How you do run on," she observed.
"If he isn't put in jail, at least he won't be re-elected. We're going to have a Democratic governor next time for a change."
"And I suppose you'll have something to do with it?" she questioned sarcastically.
"My pet, I will. I'm having something to do with it now. That's why I stay out so late at nights. I'm working harder than I ever worked with a shovel in the gold rush, trying to help get the election organized. And I know this will hurt you, Mrs. Butler, but I'm contributing plenty of money to the organization, too. Do you remember telling me years ago in Frank's store
that it was dishonest for me to keep the Confederate gold? At last, I've come to agree with you, and the Confederate gold is being spent to get the Confederates back into power.
You're pouring money down a rat hole.
What? You call the Democratic Party a rat hole?
His eyes mocked her, and then were quiet, expressionless.
It doesn't matter a damn to me who wins this election. What does matter is that everyone knows I've worked for it and that I've spent money on it. And that'll be remembered in Bonnie's favor in years to come.
I was almost afraid from your pious talk that you'd had a change of heart. But I see you've got no more sincerity about the Democrats than about anything else.
Not a change of heart at all. Merely a change of hide. You might possibly sponge the spots off a leopard, but he'd remain a leopard just the same.
Bonnie, awakened by the sound of voices in the hall, called sleepily but imperiously,
"Daddy!"
And Rhett started past Scarlet.
"Rhett, wait a minute. There's something else I want to tell you. You must stop taking Bonnie around with you in the afternoons to political meetings. It just doesn't look well. The idea of a little girl at such places. And it makes you look so silly. I never dreamed that you took her until Uncle Henry mentioned it. As though he thought I knew, and..."
He swung round on her, and his face was hard. "How can you read wrong in a little girl sitting on her father's lap while he talks to friends? You may think it looks silly, but it isn't silly. People will remember for years that Bonnie sat on my lap while I helped run the Republicans out of this state. People will remember for years..." The hardness went out of his face, and a malicious light danced in his eyes. "Did you know that when people ask her who she loves best, she says, 'Daddy and the Democrats'? And who she hates most, she says, 'The scallywags'? People, thank God, remember things like that." Scarlet's voice rose furiously.
"And I suppose you'd tell her I'm a scallywag."
"Daddy!"
said the small voice, indignant now. And Rhett, still laughing, went down the hall to his daughter. That October, Governor Bullock resigned his office and fled from Georgia. Misuse of public funds, waste and corruption had reached such proportions during his administration that the edifice was toppling of its own weight. Even his own party was split. So great had public indignation become. The Democrats had a majority in the legislature now, and that meant just one thing. Knowing that he was going to be investigated and fearing impeachment, Bullock did not wait. He hastily and secretly decamped, arranging that his resignation would not become public until he was safely in the North. When it was announced a week after his flight, Atlanta was wild with excitement and joy. People thronged the streets, men laughing and shaking hands in congratulation, ladies kissing each other and crying. Everybody gave parties in celebration, and the fire department was kept busy fighting the flames that spread from the bonfires of jubilant small boys. Almost out of the woods. Reconstruction's almost over. To be sure, the acting governor was a Republican, too, but the election was coming up in December, and there was no doubt in anyone's mind as to what the result would be. And when the election came, despite the frantic efforts of the Republicans, Georgia once more had a Democratic governor. There was joy then, excitement, too, but of a different sort from that which seized the town when Bullock took to his heels. This was a more sober, heartfelt joy, a deep-souled feeling of thanksgiving, and the churches were filled as ministers reverently thanked God for the deliverance of the state. There was pride, too, mingled with the elation and joy, pride that Georgia was back in the hands of her own people again. In spite of all the administration in Washington could do, in spite of the army, the carpetbaggers, the scallywags, and the native Republicans.
Seven times Congress had passed crushing acts against the state to keep it a conquered province. Three times the army had set aside civil law. The Negroes had frolicked through the legislature. Grasping aliens had mismanaged the government. Private individuals had enriched themselves from public funds. Georgia had been helpless, tormented, abused, hammered down. But now, in spite of them all, Georgia belonged to herself again, and through the efforts of her own people. The sudden overturn of the Republicans did not bring joy to everyone. There was consternation in the ranks of the scalawags, the carpetbaggers, and the Republicans. The Gellerts and the Hundons, evidently apprised of Bullock's departure before his resignation became public, left town abruptly, disappearing into that oblivion from which they had come. The other carpetbaggers and scalawags who remained were uncertain, frightened, and they hovered together for comfort, wondering what the legislative investigation would bring to light concerning their own private affairs. They were not insolent now. They were stunned, bewildered, afraid. And the ladies who called on Scarlett said over and over, "But who would have thought it would turn out this way? We thought the governor was too powerful. We thought he was here to stay. We thought..." Scarlett was equally bewildered by the turn of events, despite Rhett's warning as to the direction it would take. It was not that she was sorry Bullock had gone and the Democrats were back again. Though no one would have believed it, she, too, felt a grim happiness that the Yankee rule was at last thrown off. She remembered all too vividly her struggles during those first days of Reconstruction. Her fears that the soldiers and the carpetbaggers would confiscate her money and her property. She remembered her helplessness, and her panic at her helplessness, and her hatred of the Yankees who had imposed this galling system upon the South. And she had never stopped hating them. But in trying to make the best of things, in trying to obtain complete security, she had gone with the conquerors. No matter how much she disliked them, she had surrounded herself with them, cut herself off from her old friends and her old way of living. And now the power of the conquerors was at an end. She had gambled on the continuance of the Bullock regime, and she had lost. As she looked about her, that Christmas of 1871, the happiest Christmas the state had known in over 10 years, she was disquieted. She couldn't help seeing that Rhett, once the most execrated man in Atlanta, was now one of the most popular. For he had humbly recanted his Republican heresies and given his time and money and labor and thought to helping Georgia fight her way back. When he rode down the streets, smiling, tipping his hat, the small blue bundle that was Bonnie perched before him on his saddle, everyone smiled back, spoke with enthusiasm, and looked with affection on the little girl. Whereas she, Scarlett, Chapter 59. There was no doubt in anyone's mind that Bonnie Butler was running wild and needed a firm hand. But she was so general a favorite that no one had the heart to attempt the necessary firmness. She had first gotten out of control during the months when she traveled with her father. When she had been with Rhett in New Orleans and Charleston, she had been permitted to sit up as late as she pleased and had gone to sleep in his arms in theaters, restaurants, and at card tables. Thereafter, nothing short of force would make her go to bed at the same time as the obedient Ella. While she had been away with him, Rhett had let her wear any dress she chose, and since that time she had gone into tantrums when Mammy tried to dress her in dimity frocks and pinafores instead of blue taffeta and lace collars. There seemed no way to regain the ground which had been lost when the child was away from home, and later when Scarlett had been ill and at Tara. As Bonnie grew older, Scarlett tried to discipline her, tried to keep her from becoming too headstrong and spoiled, but with little success. Rhett always sided with the child, no matter how foolish her desires or how outrageous her behavior. He encouraged her to talk and treated her as an adult, listening to her opinions with apparent seriousness and pretending to be guided by them. As a result, Bonnie interrupted her elders whenever she pleased and contradicted her father and put him in his place. He only laughed and wouldn't permit Scarlett even to slap the little girl's hand by way of reprimand.
If she wasn't such a sweet, darling thing, she'd be impossible, thought Scarlett ruefully, realizing that she had a child with a will equal to her own. She adores Rhett, and he could make her behave better if he wanted to.
But Rhett showed no inclination to make Bonnie behave. Whatever she did was right, and if she wanted the moon, she could have it, if he could reach it for her. His pride in her beauty, her curls, her dimples, her graceful little gestures, was boundless. He loved her pertness, her high spirits, and the quaint, sweet manner she had of showing her love for him. For all her spoiled and willful ways, she was such a lovable child that he lacked the heart to try to curb her. He was her god, the center of her small world, and that was too precious for him to risk losing by reprimands. She clung to him like a shadow. She woke him earlier than he cared to wake, sat beside him at the table, eating alternately from his plate and her own, rode in front of him on his horse, and permitted no one but Rhett to undress her and put her to sleep in the small bed beside his. It amused and touched Scarlett to see the iron hand with which her small child ruled her father. Who would have thought that Rhett, of all people, would take fatherhood so seriously? But sometimes a dart of jealousy went through Scarlett, because Bonnie, at the age of 4, understood Rhett better than she had ever understood him, and could manage him better than she had ever managed him. When Bonnie was 4 years old, Mammy began to grumble about the impropriety of a girl child riding a straddle in front of her pa with a dress flying up. Rhett lent an attentive ear to this remark, as he did to all Mammy's remarks about the proper raising of little girls. The result was a small brown and white Shetland pony with a long silky mane and tail, and a tiny side saddle with silver trimmings. Ostensibly, the pony was for all 3 children, and Rhett bought a saddle for Wade, too. But Wade infinitely preferred his St. Bernard dog, and Ella was afraid of all animals. So the pony became Bonnie's own and was named Mr. Butler. The only flaw in Bonnie's possessive joy was that she couldn't still ride astride like her father. But after he had explained how much more difficult it was to ride on a side saddle, she was content and learned rapidly. Rhett's pride in her good seat and her good hands was enormous. "Wait till she's old enough to hunt," he boasted. "There'll be no one like her on any field. I'll take her to Virginia then. That's where the real hunting is. And Kentucky, where they appreciate good riders." When it came to making her riding habit, as usual, she had her choice of colors, and as usual, chose blue.
"But my darling, not that blue velvet. The blue velvet is for a party dress for me," laughed Scarlett. "A nice black broadcloth is what little girls wear." Seeing the small black brows coming together. "For heaven's sake, Rhett, tell her how unsuitable it would be and how dirty it will get."
"Oh, let her have the blue velvet. If it gets dirty, we'll make another one," said Rhett easily.
So Bonnie had her blue velvet habit, with a skirt that trailed down the pony's side and a black hat with a red plume in it, because Aunt Mellie's stories of Jeb Stuart's plume had appealed to her imagination. On the days that were bright and clear, the two could be seen riding down Peachtree Street, Rhett reining in his big black horse to keep pace with the fat pony's gait. Sometimes they went tearing down the quiet roads about the town, scattering chickens and dogs and children, Bonnie beating Mr. Butler with her crop, her tangled curls flying, Rhett holding in his horse with a firm hand, that she might think Mr. Butler was winning the race. When he had assured himself of her seat, her hands, her utter fearlessness, Rhett decided that the time had come for her to learn to make the low jumps that were within the reach of Mr. Butler's short legs. To this end, he built a hurdle in the backyard and paid Wash, one of Uncle Peter's small nephews, 25 cents a day to teach Mr. Butler to jump. He began with a bar 2 inches from the ground and gradually worked up to the height of a foot. This arrangement met with the disapproval of the three parties most concerned, Wash, Mr. Butler, and Bonnie. Wash was afraid of horses, and only the princely sum offered induced him to take the stubborn pony over the bar dozens of times a day. Mr. Butler, who bore with equanimity having his tail pulled by his small mistress and his hooves examined constantly, felt that the creator of ponies had not intended him to put his fat body over the bar. Bonnie, who couldn't bear to see anyone else upon her pony, danced with impatience while Mr. Butler was learning his lessons. When Rhett finally decided that the pony knew his business well enough to trust Bonnie upon him, the child's excitement was boundless. She made her first jump with flying colors, and thereafter, riding abroad with her father held no charms for her. Scarlett couldn't help laughing at the pride and enthusiasm of father and daughter. She thought, however, that once the novelty had passed, Bonnie would turn to other things, and the neighborhood would have some peace. But this sport did not pall. There was a bare track worn from the arbor at the far end of the backyard to the hurdle, and all morning long the yard resounded with excited yells. Grandpa Merriweather, who had made the overland trip in 1849, said that the yells sounded just like an Apache after a successful scalping. After the first week, Bonnie begged for a higher bar, a bar that was a foot and a half from the ground. "When you are 6 years old," said Rhett, "then you'll be big enough for a higher jump, and I'll buy you a bigger horse. Mr. Butler's legs aren't long enough."
"They are, too. I jumped at Melly's rose bushes, and they are enormously high."
"No, you must wait," said Rhett, firm for once. But the firmness gradually faded away before her incessant importunings and tantrums. "Oh, all right," he said, with a laugh one morning, and moved the narrow white crossbar higher. "If you fall off, don't cry and blame me."
"Mother!"
screamed Bonnie, turning her head up toward Scarlett's bedroom.
"Mother, watch me. Daddy says I can."
Scarlett, who was combing her hair, came to the window and smiled down at the tiny, excited figure, so absurd in the soiled blue habit.
"I must really get her another habit," she thought, "though heaven only knows how I'll make her give up that dirty one." "Mother, watch!"
"I'm watching, dear," said Scarlett, smiling.
As Rhett lifted the child and set her on the pony, Scarlett called with a swift rush of pride at the straight back and the proud set of the head.
"You're mighty pretty, precious."
"So are you,"
said Bonnie generously. And hammering a heel into Mr. Butler's ribs, she galloped down the yard toward the arbor.
"Mother, watch me take this one," she cried, laying on the crop.
"Watch me take this one." Memory rang a bell far back in Scarlett's mind. There was something ominous about those words. What was it? Why couldn't she remember? She looked down at her small daughter, so lightly poised on the galloping pony, and her brow wrinkled as a chill swept swiftly through her breast. Bonnie came on with a rush, her crisp black curls jerking, her blue eyes blazing. "They're like Paul's eyes," thought Scarlett. "Irish blue eyes, and she's just like him in every way.
And as she thought of Gerald, the memory for which she had been fumbling came to her swiftly, came with the heart-stopping clarity of summer lightning, throwing for an instant a whole countryside into unnatural brightness. She could hear an Irish voice singing, heard the hard, rapid pounding of hooves coming up the pasture hill at Tara, hear a reckless voice, so like the voice of her child. "Ellen, watch me take this one."
"No," she cried. "No! Oh, Bonnie, stop!"
Even as she leaned from the window, there was a fearful sound of splintering wood, a hoarse cry from Rhett, a melee of blue velvet and flying hooves on the ground. Then Mr. Butler scrambled to his feet and trotted off with an empty saddle. On the third night after Bonnie's death, Mammy waddled slowly up the kitchen steps of Melanie's house. She was dressed in black, from her huge men's shoes slashed to permit freedom for her toes, to her black head rag. Her blurred old eyes were bloodshot and red-rimmed, and misery cried out in every line of her mountainous figure. Her face was puckered in the sad bewilderment of an old ape, but there was determination in her jaw. She spoke a few soft words to Dilsey, who nodded kindly, as though an unspoken armistice existed in their old feud. Dilsey put down the supper dishes she was holding and went quietly through the pantry toward the dining room. In a minute, Melanie was in the kitchen, her table napkin in her hand, anxiety in her face.
"Miss Scarlet isn't..."
"Miss Scarlet's bearing up, same as always," said Mammy heavily. "I didn't intend to disturb your supper, Miss Melly. I can wait till you're through to tell you what I got on my mind."
"Supper can wait," said Melanie. "Dilsey, serve the rest of the supper. Mammy, come with me."
Mammy waddled after her down the hall past the dining room, where Ashley sat at the head of the table, his own little beau beside him, and Scarlett's two children opposite, making a great clatter with their soup spoons. The happy voices of Wade and Ella filled the room. It was like a picnic for them to spend so long a visit with Aunt Melly. Aunt Melly was always so kind, and she was especially so now. The death of their younger sister had affected them very little. Bonnie had fallen off her pony, and Mother had cried a long time. And Aunt Melly had taken them home with her to play in the backyard with Beau, and have tea cakes whenever they wanted them. Melanie led the way to the small book-lined sitting room, shut the door, and motioned Mammy to the sofa.
"I was going over right after supper," she said. "Now that Captain Butler's mother has come, I suppose the funeral will be tomorrow morning."
"The funeral, that's just it," said Mammy. "Miss Melly, we's all in deep trouble and I's come to you for help. Ain't nothing but weary load, honey. Nothing but weary load."
"Has Miss Scarlet collapsed?" questioned Melanie worriedly. "I've hardly seen her since Bonnie... She's been in her room and Captain Butler has been out of the house and..." Suddenly tears began to flow down Mammy's black face. Melanie sat down beside her and patted her arm, and for a moment... Mammy lifted the hem of her black skirt and dried her eyes.
"You got to come help us, Miss Melly. I done the best I can, but it don't do no good."
"Miss Scarlet..." Mammy straightened.
"Miss Melly, you knows Miss Scarlet well's I does. What that child got to stand, the good Lord give her strength to stand. This year done broke her heart, but she can stand it. It's Mr. Rhett I come about.
I have so wanted to see him, but whenever I've been there, he has either been downtown or locked in his room with... And Scarlet has looked like a ghost and wouldn't speak. Tell me quickly, Mammy. You know I'll help if I can."
Mammy wiped her nose on the back of her hand.
"I say Miss Scarlet can stand what the Lord's in,"
"'cause she done had the stand a-plenty but Mr. Rat. "'Miss Melly, he ain't never had to stand nothing he didn't want to stand. "'Not nothing. "'It's him I come to see you about. "'But, Miss Melly, you got to come home with me this evening.'
"'There was an urgency in Mammy's voice.
"'Maybe Mr. Rat listened to you. "'He always did think a heap of your opinion.'
"'Oh, Mammy, what is it? What do you mean?'
Mammy squared her shoulders.
"'Miss Melly, Mr. Rhett done lost his mind. "'He won't let us put little Miss away.'
"'Lost his mind? Oh, Mammy, no!
"'I ain't lying. It's the God's truth.' "'He ain't gwine to let us bear that child. "'He done told me so hisself not more an hour ago.'
"'But he can't. He isn't.
"'That's how come I say he's lost his mind.
"'But why,
Miss Melly, I tell you everything. "'I oughtn't to tell nobody. "'But you is our family, and you is the onlyest one I can tell. "'I tell you everything. "'You knows what a store he sets by that child. "'I ain't never seen no man, black or white, "'set such a store by any child. "'Look like he go plumb crazy when Dr. Mead say her neck broke. "'He grab his gun and he run right out and shoot that pony, "'and for God, I think he gwan shoot himself. "'I was plumb distracted, what with Miss Scarlet in a swoon, "'and all the neighbors in and out of the house.' "'And Mr. Rhett carrying on and just holding that child "'and not even letting me wash a little face where the gravel cut it. "'And when Miss Scarlet come to, I think, bless God, "'now they can comfort each other.'
"'Again the tears began to fall, but this time Mammy didn't even wipe them away.
"'But when she come to, she go into the room where he's sitting holding Miss Bonnie, and she say, "'Give me my baby what you killed.'
"'Oh, no, she couldn't.'
"'Yes'm, that what she say. "'She say you killed her. "'And I felt so sorry for Mr. Rhett. "'I bust out crying, "'cause he looked like a whoop hound. "'And I say, "'Give that child to its mammy. "'I ain't gonna have no such goings-on over my little miss. "'And I take the child away from him, "'and take her into the room and wash her face. "'And I hear them talking, "'and it like to turn my blood cold, what they say. "'Miss Scarlet was calling him a murderer "'for letting her try to jump that high, "'and him saying Miss Scarlet hadn't never cared "'nothing about Miss Bunny nor none of her children. "'Stop, Mammy. Don't tell me any more. "'It isn't right for you to tell me this,' cried Melanie, "'her mind shrinking away from the picture Mammy's words evoked.
"'I knows I got no business telling you, "'but my heart too full to know just what not to say. "'Then he took her to the undertaker's himself, "'and he bring her back, and he put her in her bed in his room. "'And when Miss Scarlet say she belong in the parlor in the coffin, "'I thought Mr. Rhett gwan hit her. "'And he say right cold-like, "'she belong in my room.' "'And he turned to me and he say, "'Mammy, you see that she stay right here "'till I gets back.' "'Then he light out of the house on the horse "'and he was gone till about sundown. "'When he come tearing home, "'I see that he'd been drinking and drinking heavy, "'but he was carrying it well as usual. "'He fling into the house "'and not even speak to Miss Scarlet or Miss Pity "'or any of the ladies as was calling. "'But he fly up the steps and to open the door of his room, "'and then he yell for me. "'When I comes running as fast as I can, "'he was standing by the bed, "'and it was so dark in the room I couldn't scarcely see him, "'cause the shutters was done drawed. "'And he say to me, right fierce like, "'Open them shutters, it's dark in here.' "'And I flinged him open, and he look at me, "'and, for God, Miss Melly, my knees about give way, "'cause he looked so strange. "'Then he said, "'Bring lots of lights, "'and keep them burning.
and don't draw no shades or no shutters. Don't you know Miss Bonnie's afraid of the dark?
Melanie's horror-struck eyes met Mammy's, and Mammy nodded ominously.
That's what he say. Miss Bonnie's afraid of the dark.
Mammy shivered.
When I gets him a dozen candles, he said, git. And then he locked the door. And there he sat with little miss. And he didn't open the door for Miss Scarlet, even when she beat and hollered to him. And that's the way it's been for 2 days. He won't say nothing about the funeral. And in the morning, he locked the door and get on his horse and go off to town. And he come back at sundown drunk and lock himself in again. And he ain't ate nothing nor slept none. And now his ma, old Miss Butler, she come from Charleston for the funeral, and Miss Sue Ellen and Mr. Will, they come from Tara. But Mr. Rhett won't talk to none of them. Oh, Miss Millie, it's been awful. And it's going to be worse, and folks going to talk something scandalous. And then this evening, Mammy paused and again wiped her nose on her hand. This evening, Miss Scarlet catch him in the upstairs hall when he come in. And she go in the room with him, and she say, the funeral set for tomorrow morning. And he say, do dat, and I kills you tomorrow. Oh, he must have lost his mind. Yes'm. And then they talks kind of low, and I don't hear all what they say, except he say again about Miss Bonnie being scared of the dark, and the gray, powerful dark. And after a while, Miss Scarlet say, you is a fine one to talk on so, after killing it to please your pride. And he say, ain't you got no mercy? And she say, no, and I ain't got no child neither. And I'm wore out with the way you been acting since Bonnie was killed. You is a scandal to the town. You been drunk all the time, and if you don't think I knows where you been spending your days, you is a fool. I know you been down to that creature's house, that Belle Watling. Oh, Mammy, no. Yes'm, that what she said. And Miss Melly, it's the truth. Niggers knows a heap of things quicker than white folks. And I knowed that's where he been, but I ain't said nothing about it. And he don't deny it. He say, yes'm, that's where I been. And you needn't take on, 'cause you don't give a damn. A body house is a haven of refuge after this house of hell. And Bella's got one of the world's kindest hearts. She don't throw it up to me that I done killed my child. Oh, cried Melanie, stricken to the heart. Her own life was so pleasant, so sheltered, so wrapped about with people who loved her, so full of kindness, that what Mammy told her was almost beyond comprehension or belief. Yet there crawled into her mind a memory, a picture which she hastily put from her, as she would put from her the thought of another's nudity. Rhett had spoken of Belle Watling the day he cried with his head on her knees. But he loved Scarlet. She could not have been mistaken that day. And of course Scarlet loved him. What had come between them? How could a husband and a wife cut each other to pieces with such sharp knives? Mammy took up her story heavily. After a while, Miss Scarlet come out of the room, white as a sheet, but a jaw set. And she see me standing there, and she say, the funeral tomorrow, Mammy. And she passed by me like a ghost. Then my heart turned over, 'cause what Miss Scarlet say, she mean. And what Mr. Rhett say, he mean too. And he say he kill her if she do that. I was plumb distracted, Miss Melly, 'cause I done had something on my conscience all the time, and it weighing me down. Miss Melly, it was me as scared little miss in the dark. Oh, but Mammy, it doesn't matter. Not now. Yes, me do. That was the whole trouble. And it come to me, I better tell Miss Dredd, even if it kill me, 'cause it on my conscience. So I slip in the door real quick, before he can lock it, and I say, Miss Dredd, I's come to confess. And he swing around on me like a crazy man and say, Git. And for God, I ain't never been so scared. But I say, please, sir, Miss Dredd, let me tell you, it's about to kill me. It was me who scared little miss of the dark. And then, Miss Millie, I put my head down and waited for him to hit me. But he didn't say nothing. And I say, I didn't mean no harm. But Miss Dredd, that child didn't have no caution, and she wasn't scared of nothing. And she was always getting out of bed after everybody sleep and running round the house barefoot, and it worried me, 'cause I afraid she hurt herself. So I tells her there's ghosts and bugaboos in the dark. And then, Miss Mellie, you know what he done? His face got right gentle-like, and he come to me and put his hand on my arm. That's the first time he ever done that. And he say, she was so brave, wasn't she? Except for the dog, she wasn't scared of nothing. And when I bust out crying, he say, now, Mammy, and he pat me. Now, Mammy, don't you carry on so. I's glad you told me. I knows you love Miss Bonnie, and 'cause you love her, it don't matter. It's what the heart is that matter. Well, that kind of cheered me up. And I venture to say, Mr. Retzer, what about the funeral? Then he turn on me like a wild man, and his eyes glitter, and he say, good God, I thought you understand, even if nobody else didn't. Does you think I'm going to put my child away in the dark when she's so scared of it? Right now, I can hear the way she used to scream when she wake up in the dark. I ain't going to have her scared. Miss Millie, then I know he lost his mind. He drunk and he needs sleep and something to eat, but that ain't all. He plumb crazy. He just pushed me out of the door and say, get the hell out of here. I goes downstairs, and I gets to thinking that he say there ain't gwine be no funeral, and Miss Scarlett say it be tomorrow morning, and he say they're gonna be shooting. And all the kinfolks in the house and all the neighbors already gabbling about it like a flock of guinea hens, and I thought of you, Miss Millie. You got to come help us. Oh, Mammy, I couldn't intrude. If you can't, who can? But what could I do, Mammy? Miss Millie, I don't know. But you can do something. You can talk to Mr. Rhett, and maybe he'll listen to you. He set a great store by you, Miss Millie. Maybe you don't know it, but he do. I done hear him say time and again, you is the onliest great lady he knows. But Melanie rose to her feet, confused, her heart quailing at the thought of confronting Rhett. The thought of arguing with a man as grief-crazed as the one Mammy depicted made her go cold. The thought of entering that brightly lighted room where lay the little girl she loved so much wrung her heart. What could she do? What could she say to Rhett that would ease his grief and bring him back to reason? For a moment she stood irresolute, and through the closed door came the sound of her boy's treble laughter. Like a cold knife in her heart came the thought of him dead. Suppose her beau were lying upstairs, his little body cold and still, his merry laughter hushed. Oh! She cried aloud in fright, and in her mind she clutched him close to her heart. She knew how Rhett felt. If beau were dead, how could she put him away, alone with the wind and rain and the darkness? Oh, poor, poor Captain Butler, she cried. I'll go to him now, right away.
She sped back to the dining room and said a few soft words to Ashley, and surprised her little boy by hugging him close to her and kissing his blonde curls passionately. She left the house without a hat, her dinner napkin still clutched in her hand, and the pace she set was hard for Mammy's old legs. Once in Scarlet's front hall, she bowed briefly to the gathering in the library, to the frightened Miss Pittypat, the stately old Mrs. Butler, Will and Sue Ellen. She went up the stairs swiftly, with Mammy panting behind her. For a moment, she paused before Scarlet's closed door, but Mammy hissed, "Norm, don't do that." Down the hall, Melly went, more slowly now, and stopped in front of Rhett's room. She stood irresolutely for a moment, as though she longed to take flight. Then, bracing herself like a small soldier going into battle, she knocked on the door and called softly, "Please, let me in, Captain Butler. It's Mrs. Wilkes. I want to see Bonnie." The door opened quickly, and Mammy, shrinking back into the shadows of the hall, saw Rhett huge and dark against the blazing background of candles. He was swaying on his feet, and Mammy could smell the whiskey on his breath. He looked down at Melly for a moment, and then, taking her by the arm, he pulled her into the room and shut the door. Mammy edged herself stealthily to a chair beside the door and sank into it wearily, her shapeless body overflowing it. She sat still, weeping silently and praying. Now and then she lifted the hem of her dress and wiped her eyes. Strain her ears as hard as she might, she could hear no words from the room. Only a low, broken, humming sound. After an interminable period, the door cracked open, and Melly's face, white and strained, appeared. "Bring me a pot of coffee quickly, and some sandwiches." When the devil drove, Mammy could be as swift as a lithe black 16-year-old, and her curiosity to get into Rhett's room made her work faster. But her hope turned to disappointment when Melly merely opened the door a crack and took the tray. For a long time, Mammy strained her sharp ears, but she could distinguish nothing except the clatter of silver on china and the muffled soft tones of Melanie's voice. Then she heard the creaking of the bed as a heavy body fell upon it, and soon after, the sound of boots dropping to the floor. After an interval, Melanie appeared in the doorway, but strive though she might, Mammy couldn't see past her into the room. Melanie looked tired, and there were tears glistening on her lashes, but her face was serene again. "Go tell Miss Scarlet that Captain Butler is quite willing for the funeral to take place tomorrow morning," she whispered.
"Bless God!" ejaculated Mammy. "How on earth—"
"Don't talk so loud. He's going to sleep. And, Mammy, tell Miss Scarlet, too, that I'll be here all night. And you bring me some coffee. Bring it here."
"To this year room?"
"Yes. I promised Captain Butler that if he would go to sleep, I would sit up by her all night. Now go tell Miss Scarlet, so she won't worry any more." Mammy started off down the hall, her weight shaking the floor, her relieved heart singing, "Hallelujah, hallelujah." She paused thoughtfully outside of Scarlet's door, her mind in a ferment of thankfulness and curiosity. How Miss Melly done it beyond me. The angels fired on her side, I specs. I'll tell Miss Scarlet the funeral tomorrow, but I specs I better keep heard that Miss Melly settin' up with Lil Miss. Miss Scarlet ain't gwanna like that at all."
Chapter 60. Something was wrong with the world. A somber, frightening wrongness that pervaded everything like a dark, impenetrable mist, stealthily closing around Scarlet. This wrongness went even deeper than Bonnie's death. For now the first unbearable anguish was fading into resigned acceptance of her loss. Yet this eerie sense of disaster to come persisted, as though something black and hooded stood just at her shoulder, as though the ground beneath her feet might turn to quicksand as she trod upon it. She had never before known this type of fear. All her life, her feet had been firmly planted in common sense, and the only thing she had ever feared had been the things she could see. Injury, hunger, poverty, loss of Ashley's love. Unanalytical, she was trying to analyze now, and with no success. She had lost her dearest child, but she could stand that somehow, as she had stood other crushing losses. She had her health. She had as much money as she could wish, and she still had Ashley, though she saw less and less of him these days. Even the constraint which had been between them since the day of Melanie's ill-starred surprise party didn't worry her, for she knew it would pass. No, her fear was not of pain or hunger or loss of love. Those fears had never weighed her down, as this feeling of wrongness was doing. This blighting fear that was oddly like that which she knew in her old nightmare, a thick, swimming mist through which she ran with bursting heart. A lost child seeking a haven that was hidden from her. She remembered how Rhett had always been able to laugh her out of her fears. She remembered the comfort of his broad brown chest and his strong arms. And so she turned to him with eyes that really saw him for the first time in weeks. And the change she saw shocked her. This man was not going to laugh, nor was he going to comfort her. For some time after Bonnie's death, she had been too angry with him, too preoccupied with her own grief to do more than speak politely in front of the servants. She had been too busy remembering the swift running patter of Bonnie's feet and her bubbling laugh to think that he, too, might be remembering, and with pain even greater than her own. Throughout these weeks, they had met and spoken as courteously as strangers meeting in the impersonal walls of a hotel, sharing the same roof, the same table, but never sharing the thoughts of each other. Now that she was frightened and lonely, she would have broken through this barrier if she could. But she found that he was holding her at arm's length, as though he wished to have no words with her that went beneath the surface. Now that her anger was fading, she wanted to tell him that she held him guiltless of Bonnie's death. She wanted to cry in his arms and say that she, too, had been overly proud of the child's horsemanship, overly indulgent to her weedlings. Now she would willingly have humbled herself and admitted that she had only hurled that accusation at him out of her misery, hoping by hurting him to alleviate her own hurt. But there never seemed an opportune moment. He looked at her out of black, blank eyes that made no opportunity for her to speak. And apologies, once postponed, became harder and harder to make, and finally, impossible. She wondered why this should be. Rhett was her husband, and between them there was the unbreakable bond of two people who have shared the same bed, begotten and born a loved child, and seen that child too soon laid away in the dark. Only in the arms of the father of that child could she find comfort. In the exchange of memories and grief that might hurt at first, but would help to heal. But now, as matters stood between them, she would as soon go to the arms of a complete stranger. He was seldom home. When they did sit down to supper together, he was usually drunk. He wasn't drinking as he had formerly, becoming increasingly more polished and biting as the liquor took hold of him, saying amusing, malicious things that made her laugh in spite of herself. Now he was silently, morosely drunk. And as the evenings progressed, soddenly drunk. Sometimes in the early hours of the dawn, she heard him ride into the backyard and beat on the door of the servant's house so that Pork might help him up the back stairs and put him to bed. Put him to bed! Rhett, who had always drunk others under the table without turning a hair, and then put them to bed. He was untidy now, where once he had been well-groomed, and it took all Pork's scandalized arguing even to make him change his linen before supper. Whiskey was showing in his face, and the hard line of his long jaw was being obscured under an unhealthy bloat and puffs rising under his bloodshot eyes. His big body with its hard swelling muscles looked soft and slack, and his waistline began to thicken. Often he didn't come home at all or even send word that he would be away overnight. Of course, he might be snoring drunkenly in some room above a saloon, but Scarlet always believed that he was at Belle Watling's house on these occasions. Once she had seen Belle in a store, a coarse, overblown woman now, with most of her good looks gone. But for all her paint and flashy clothes, she was buxom and almost motherly-looking. Instead of dropping her eyes or glaring defiantly, as did other light women when confronted by ladies, Belle gave her stare for stare, searching her face with an intent, almost pitying look that brought a flush to Scarlet's cheek. But she couldn't accuse him now, couldn't rage at him, demand fidelity or try to shame him, any more than she could bring herself to apologize for accusing him of Bonnie's death. She was clutched by a bewildered apathy, an unhappiness that she couldn't understand, an unhappiness that went deeper than anything she had ever known. She was lonely, and she could never remember being so lonely before. Perhaps she had never had the time to be very lonely until now. She was lonely and afraid, and there was no one to whom she could turn, no one except Melanie. For now even Mammy, her mainstay, had gone back to Terra. Gone, permanently. Mammy gave no explanation for her departure. Her tired old eyes looked sadly at Scarlet when she asked for the train fare home. To Scarlet's tears and pleading that she stay, Mammy only answered,
"Look to me like Miss Ellen say to me. Mammy, come home. Your work done finish." So I's gone home.
Rhett, who had listened to the talk, gave Mammy the money and patted her arm.
"You're right, Mammy. Miss Ellen is right. Your work here is done. Go home. Let me know if you ever need anything."
And as Scarlet broke into renewed indignant commands,
"Hush, you fool! Let her go! Why should anyone want to stay in this house? Now!"
There was such a savage, bright glitter in his eyes when he spoke that Scarlet shrank from him, frightened.
"Dr. Meade, do you think he can have lost his mind?" she questioned afterwards, driven to the doctor by her own sense of helplessness.
"No," said the doctor. "But he's drinking like a fish and will kill himself if he keeps it up. He loved the child, Scarlet, and I think he drinks to forget about her. Now my advice to you, miss, is to give him another baby just as quickly as you can."
"Ha!" thought Scarlet bitterly, as she left his office. That was easier said than done. She would gladly have another child, several children, if they would take that look out of Rhett's eyes and fill up the aching spaces in her own heart. A boy who had Rhett's dark handsomeness, and another little girl. Oh, for another little girl, pretty and gay and willful and full of laughter, not like the giddy-brained Ella. Why, oh, why couldn't God have taken Ella if he had to take one of her children? Ella was no comfort to her,
now that Bonnie was gone. But Rhett didn't seem to want any other children. At least he never came to her bedroom, though now the door was never locked, and usually invitingly ajar. He didn't seem to care. He didn't seem to care for anything now except whiskey and that blousy red-haired woman. He was bitter now. Where he had been pleasantly jeering, brutal. Where his thrusts had once been tempered with humor. After Bonnie died, many of the good ladies of the neighborhood who had been won over to him by his charming manners with his daughter were anxious to show him kindness. They stopped him on the street to give him their sympathy and spoke to him from over their hedges, saying that they understood. But now that Bonnie, the reason for his good manners, was gone, the manners went too. He cut the ladies and their well-meant condolences off shortly, rudely. But oddly enough, the ladies weren't offended. They understood, or thought they understood. When he rode home in the twilight, almost too drunk to stay in the saddle, scowling at those who spoke to him, the ladies said, "Poor thing," and redoubled their efforts to be kind and gentle. They felt very sorry for him, broken-hearted and riding home to no better comfort than Scarlet. Everybody knew how cold and heartless she was. Everybody was appalled at the seeming ease with which she had recovered from Bonnie's death, never realizing or caring to realize the effort that lay behind that seeming recovery. Rhett had the town's tenderest sympathy, and he neither knew nor cared. Scarlet had the town's dislike, and for once, she would have welcomed the sympathy of old friends. Now, none of her old friends came to the house, except Aunt Pity, Melanie, and Ashley. Only the new friends came calling in their shining carriages, anxious to tell her of their sympathy, eager to divert her with gossip about other new friends in whom she was not at all interested. All these new people, strangers, every one, they didn't know her. They would never know her. They had no realization of what her life had been before she reached her present safe eminence in her mansion on Peachtree Street. They didn't care to talk about what their lives had been before they attained stiff brocades and victorias with fine teams of horses. They didn't know of her struggles, her privations, all the things that made this great house and pretty clothes and silver and receptions worth having. They didn't know. They didn't care. These people from God knows where, who seemed to live always on the surface of things, who had no common memories of war and hunger and fighting, who had no common roots going down into the same red earth. Now, in her loneliness, she would have liked to while away the afternoons with Maybelle or Fanny, or Mrs. Elsing or Mrs. Whiting, or even that redoubtable old warrior, Mrs. Merriweather, or Mrs. Bunnell, or any of her old friends and neighbors. For they knew. They had known war and terror and fire, had seen dear ones dead before their time. They had hungered and been ragged, had lived with a wolf at the door. And they had rebuilt fortune from ruin. It would be a comfort to sit with Maybelle, remembering that Maybelle had buried a baby, dead in the mad flight before Sherman. There would be solace in Fanny's presence, knowing that she and Fanny both had lost husbands in the black days of martial law. It would be grim fun to laugh with Mrs. Elsing, recalling the old lady's face as she flogged her horse through Five Points the day Atlanta fell, her loot from the commissary jouncing from her carriage. It would be pleasant to match stories with Mrs. Merriweather, now secure on the proceeds of her bakery. Pleasant to say, "Do you remember how bad things were right after the surrender? Do you remember when we didn't know where our next pair of shoes was coming from?
And look at us now.
Yes. It would be pleasant. Now she understood why, when two ex-Confederates met, they talked of the war with so much relish, with pride, with nostalgia. Those had been days that tried their hearts, but they had come through them. They were veterans. She was a veteran, too. But she had no cronies with whom she could refight old battles. Oh, to be with her own kind of people again. Those people who had been through the same things and knew how they hurt. And yet how great a part of you they were. But somehow, these people had slipped away. She realized that it was her own fault. She had never cared until now. Now that Bonnie was dead, and she was lonely and afraid. And she saw across her shining dinner table a swarthy, sodden stranger, disintegrating under her eyes. Chapter 61. Scarlett was in Marietta when Rhett's urgent telegram came. There was a train leaving for Atlanta in 10 minutes, and she caught it, carrying no baggage except her reticule, and leaving Wade and Ella at the hotel with Prissy. Atlanta was only 20 miles away, but the train crawled interminably through the wet early autumn afternoon, stopping at every bypath for passengers. Panic-stricken at Rhett's message, mad for speed, Scarlett almost screamed at every halt. Down the road lumbered the train through forests faintly, tiredly gold. Past red hillsides still scarred with serpentine breastworks. Past old battery emplacements and weed-grown craters. Down the road over which Johnston's men had retreated so bitterly, fighting every step of the way. Each station, each crossroad the conductor called was the name of a battle, the site of a skirmish. Once they would have stirred Scarlett to memories of terror. But now she had no thought for them. Rhett's message had been, "Mrs. Wilkes ill. Come home immediately." Twilight had fallen when the train pulled into Atlanta, and a light misting rain obscured the town. The gas street lamps glowed dully, blobs of yellow in the fog. Rhett was waiting for her at the depot with the carriage. The very sight of his face frightened her more than his telegram. She had never seen it so expressionless before. "She isn't," she cried. "No, she's still alive." Rhett assisted her into the carriage. "To Mrs. Wilkes' house, and as fast as you can go," he ordered the coachman. "What's the matter with her? I didn't know she was ill. She looked all right last week. Did she have an accident?" "Oh, Rhett, it isn't really a serious issue."
"She's dying," said Rhett, and his voice had no more expression than his face. "She wants to see you."
"Not Melly. Oh, not Melly. What's happened to her?"
"She's had a miscarriage."
But Rhett, she..."
Scarlett floundered. This information on top of the horror of his announcement took her breath away. "You did not know she was going to have a baby?" She couldn't even shake her head. "Ah, well, I suppose not. I don't think she told anyone. She wanted it to be a surprise. But I knew."
"You knew? But surely she didn't tell you."
"She didn't have to tell me. I knew. She's been so happy these last 2 months, I knew it couldn't mean anything else."
"But Rhett, the doctor said it would kill her to have another baby."
"It has killed her," said Rhett. and to the coachman. For God's sake, can't you drive faster?
But, Rhett, she can't be dying. I didn't.
She hasn't your strength. She never had any strength. She's never had anything but heart. The carriage rocked to a standstill in front of the flat little house, and Rhett handed her out, trembling, frightened. A sudden feeling of loneliness upon her, she clasped his arm.
You're coming in, Rhett?
No, he said, and got back into the carriage. She flew up the front steps, across the porch, and threw open the door. There, in the yellow lamplight, were Ashley, Aunt Pity, and India. Scarlet thought, what's India doing here? Melanie told her never to set foot in this house again. The three rose at the side of her, Aunt Pity biting her trembling lips distilled them. India staring at her, grief-stricken and without hate. Ashley looked dull as a sleepwalker, and as he came to her and put his hand upon her arm, he spoke like a sleepwalker. She asked for you, he said. She asked for you.
Can I see her now?
She turned toward the closed door of Melanie's room.
No. Dr. Mead is in there now.
I'm glad you've come, Scarlet.
I came as quickly as I could. Scarlet shed her bonnet and her cloak. The train... She isn't really... Tell me she's better, isn't she, Ashley? Speak to me. Don't look like that. She isn't really...
She kept asking for you, said Ashley, and looked her in the eyes. And in his eyes, she saw the answer to her question. For a moment, her heart